The School of Fashion and Textiles at Melbourne's RMIT University welcomes hundreds of new students every year. Students who are passionate about fashion and want to join the excitement of an industry on the cutting edge of design, technology, and digital innovation. But what do these students do when they finish their degrees and head out into the world? Hello and welcome to the Critical Fashion Studies podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Harriet Richards. I'm a lecturer in the School of Fashion and Textiles at RMIT University and co-founder of the Critical Fashion Studies Research Group. In today's episode, I'm talking to Juanita Page, an RMIT alumnus and proud Goreng Goreng and South Sea Islander woman. After graduating with a Bachelor of Fashion Technology in 2017, Juanita founded the slow fashion menswear brand, Joseph & James. Today, we'll be talking about finding your feet in Australia's fashion industry. Before we get started, I'd like to acknowledge that this episode was recorded on the unceded lands of the Woiwurrung and Boomerang language groups of the Eastern Kulin Nation. We pay our deep respects to First Nations elders, past and present, and to any Indigenous listeners tuning in. Thank you so much, Juanita, for joining us today. I've been really looking forward to talking to you. I wanted to start by asking you about what brought you to fashion and to Victoria. So originally, I think you're from Queensland. So if you could tell us a little bit about why you moved to Melbourne and what brought you to studying fashion.
Yeah, well, for me, I have always wanted to be in fashion. That's something I have known since the bright age of 10, can you believe? Just one of those people who, I guess, for some unknown reason, just knew that's the industry I wanted to be in, and specifically design as well. So that, I guess, propelled me to study for the first time up in Queensland, actually. So I studied at Metropolitan South Institute of TAFE, and I was recommended that course because it was more hands-on. And that's, I found that I learn better that way. So studied there for about 6 months, but they didn't have HEX. And by the time I got to my second semester, I was like, can't afford this and still live and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I ended up going back to work. My boyfriend at the time, we got engaged, eventually got married. And then I decided, like, I really want to get back into study. This is what I want to do. But then faced a choice of, do I want to go back to MSIT or do I want to find somewhere else that might be more beneficial or what have you? So that's really what drew me to Melbourne, because mm-hmm. at the time RMIT was the best in Australia for fashion. So I was like, okay, well, may as well apply and see what happens. Yeah. And got in, and that was pretty much it. We were just like, well, let's go.
Yeah.
And we've never left. So that's pretty much it in a nutshell.
Amazing. So a lot of students finish studying and feel a kind of sense of confusion about what they want to do next. I certainly see that with my students. But obviously you knew from a young age that you wanted to be in fashion. Mm. Did you know that you wanted to start your own brand?
Yeah, that was definitely part of it. I'm not sure really what was the catalyst to me kind of knowing I want to be in fashion and I want to be a designer and I want to have my own brand. That was always kind of the package that I kind of saw for myself in terms of career. And along the way, I found that that's quite an uncommon thing to have that kind of direction or know where exactly you want to sit in the industry. So I guess my advice in terms of like graduates and things like that is, if you're a bit unsure or like confused or like you've got into this course and you've liked different aspects of it, but where does that take you after study, is what are the things that you connect with? Is it design? Does it happen to be pattern making, or is it that you like the merchandising aspect of it, whatever it is that you've been studying? Or maybe you haven't found it yet, I don't know. But the advice that I tend to give is find things that ignite that passion, ignite that creativity for you. And it might actually not even be within fashion, but you've studied something that can correlate in another industry.
Yeah.
And just look at those things. But also another thing that I've found that could be a good, I guess, catalyst for finding where you want to go is, who are the brands that you really connect with? Can you do an internship with them? Mm. Or is there someone in the industry that you really look up to? Can you connect with them for a coffee and ask them different questions? And then things can go from there. So that's kind of my advice, is to find different areas that you find enjoyment or find passion that gets ignited in those ways and go from there.
Yeah, that's a great point, both about the transferable skills that students are learning, but also the figuring out where you sit. And I think a lot of students don't even know all of the multitude of different jobs that exist within the industry.
It's a huge industry, yeah.
Yeah, so kind of getting to know all of those nooks and crannies to work out where you might fit. And so your brand itself, Joseph & James, is a menswear brand.
Yes.
So did you know then that you wanted to do menswear? What brought you to that
point? Yeah, well, for me, the initial kind of what drew me into fashion was womenswear, was watching different awards shows, like the red carpet element of that, specifically looking at women and going, oh my gosh, I look amazing. I want to be the person they say when they're like, what are you wearing? It's me. and, you know, different fashion shows that might come on TV, I'd watch them with my mom. And so that really drew me into the romanticism of evening wear and ball gowns or wedding dresses, all that kind of stuff. And that's where I thought I was going to sit within the industry. But then when I studied for the first time back in Queensland, I noticed everyone was doing women's wear and it wasn't a prerequisite. It wasn't like you have to do this to then maybe do men's wear next or something like that. It was just, okay, we're going to do a design activity. Everyone was doing women's wear. And I found that really interesting. And it kind of was the catalyst to me ending up doing men's wear, actually, because it was like, well, who's designing for people who aren't women or who aren't buying women's wear, you know? Yeah. And what does that look like? Would I even enjoy doing that? Was that something that I would even be good at? I don't know. And so that kind of took me down a rabbit hole of designing menswear, and I found that I really liked it. And yeah, it really sparked creativity for me in terms of playing with different tailoring aspects. I found that my design aesthetic was very detail-oriented, those types of aspects of design, and that really set up my aesthetic long-term too, because I like tailoring, I love the clean lines and all those different things, but then I wanted it to be more wearable, and playing with streetwear and bringing those two elements together, and that really has been my aesthetic since then. So yeah, it's just a whole lot of exploration and asking questions and having fun along the way and finding what it is that sparks that creativity and staying in that kind of zone.
So once you decided that you wanted to launch and you kind of came up with this concept, you knew you wanted to do menswear, what did the process then look like? So, you know, what are the steps that you take? You know, you've said a lot of experimentation, maybe some trial and error.
Yeah.
What are some of the things that have gone well and some of those challenges that maybe haven't gone so well?
Well, because this has always been, you know, eventually I'll start the brand. That's always been the dream.
Yeah.
And so end of 2019, that was like, okay, this is the time. I ended where I was working at, also working at a design agency, finished working there. And then we were like, well, nothing's stopping us from starting this dream, which it very much was. And yeah, 2020. So that
unexpected spanner in the works.
Did not see that coming. But yeah, that really put everything kind of on hold. But it did allow us to set up the business aspect of everything. So more of the not as exciting type stuff, ABN, looking into your finances, getting a financial advisor. What should we be doing with our funds when we actually get them, if we get them, or, you know, that kind of stuff, which sent us down another rabbit hole into what are trusts and how do we look at all of that kind of stuff. But yeah, so we set up the business side of things before we started going into the more design aspect of it. And working at the design agency that I started while I was still in uni, I'd worked there for about 3.5 years, and they really set me up with a good foundation of understanding what it takes to do product development, to work with manufacturers offshore and all that kind of stuff, to develop your own fabrics and those kinds of things that I focus on when I'm designing as well, custom fabrics, all that kind of thing. So having that experience outside of uni, like real life experience, definitely helped to understand, okay, what processes, what things are required of me to communicate with these manufacturers or fabric mills, all that kind of stuff. Because oftentimes they're using lingo as well, like abbreviations of stuff, like just understanding the lingo and different aspects of what is required in terms of how you pay them and when, and is it all of the money up front? Sometimes it is. And can you do that? So it was very much, I guess, an understanding of the processes from the get-go, and having the context that I'd had from working in the industry definitely helped. Yeah, I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's potentially an unusual way of going about things, you know, working on the business side of things before the design.
Yep.
Whereas I know a lot of designers work the other way around
and they try
and like retrofit a business design, which can be very challenging.
Definitely. Mm. And I think too, for me, because I already had a clear idea of what my aesthetic was, there wasn't any kind of, oh, I need to kind of work that out. or do trial and error in that space. So it was more, I have no idea about business.
Yeah.
I have no idea what that looks like. Maybe we should fix that and organize that first so that this other side that might potentially be easier can have that flow about it because you're not worrying about the business side of things.
Yeah. And I know your first collection, I think, was produced offshore and then you bought production onshore.
Yep.
And earlier in the season, we spoke to Julia Vandersommen from the Sample Room about the costs of onshore versus offshore. I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about your experience with both, because I think that's quite unusual as well, having that experience navigating the process of onshore and offshore.
Yeah, yeah. There's definitely pros and cons to both. Our first collection, it was still very much pandemic times. So we launched officially in 2021. So we weren't actually able to travel to our manufacturer. So having the contacts that I had through the design agency that I worked at allowed me to have confidence in the manufacturers that I was using. But it's definitely beneficial for you to go there to see the factories, to talk to the people, to be there hands-on. If you're able to go there before they start bulk and iron out any like last-minute kind of issues with fit or whatever, then that's absolutely fantastic. But if not, then you're kind of just hoping and praying that the last sample you've received is exactly what the bulk is going to look like. And so there were elements of that that were really good, customized fabric, all that kind of stuff, not having to engage with so many different people as you need to do in local production. You have to engage with pattern maker, with the manufacturer, of course, find all your fabrics, all your trims, get your labels made, all of that stuff. You have to do every single step and then send it to the maker. Whereas offshore, oftentimes all you need to send is a tech pack and they can organize everything else. So the tech pack itself does take time, but if that's the most time that you're spending on something, you're definitely saving a lot of time, a lot of effort in having to source other things. And it's interesting doing both because local production is fantastic in terms of location. I had a factory that was just down the road from me, ECA accredited. I knew the people. I spoke to makers face to face. We were able to go in there and like film behind the scenes stuff and be there as part of the cutting process as well. So I knew that the fabric was being, it was a one-way print, so making sure that it was cut the right way, all that kind of stuff for my peace of mind too. I'm like, let me know when it's getting cut so I can be there. And like those elements are fantastic to have as part of that process because you know what is happening, you can iron out things firsthand, all that kind of stuff. Whereas offshore can be harder in that respect. But then the interesting thing is that here we don't always have the technology to be able to create things that we want to create. And so if you're trying to do 100% local made, that's fantastic. But then you're having to compromise on different elements too, whether that's design or, you know, whatever it may be. You might not be able to do the type of knitwear that you want to do because we don't have all of the technologies to do that here as you might have offshore. So there's definitely pros and cons to both. I think at this point in time, moving forward, I would like to do both. What that looks like, I'm not 100% sure yet, but I would like to do as much as I can here to try and invest in this industry so that we can potentially get better technology in future and be able to bring more production onshore. But then other things that might be maybe we don't have the capabilities for, or it is changing design a little bit too much and compromising too much in that aspect, then I might move that offshore.
Yeah, that's a really interesting approach because I think there's often a very simplistic comparison between one being better than the other. So you are also committed to a slower, more considered sort of production method, which I guess reflects that local commitment. And you've joined the 1% for the Planet campaign to demonstrate your concern for sustainability. I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about those considerations in your process.
But oftentimes you will be starting with fabric. And so where is that fabric coming from? What is the content that's involved in that? How can I make it better? So for us, we've done a lot of custom fabric that's quite big in terms of how I design, especially with smaller collections, trying to make it uniform so that it's you can mix and match within the collection, but also creating a look that's also cohesive to what you already have. I have found it easier to do custom fabrics, but at the same time, we also have fantastic fabric agents here. And utilizing deadstock fabric is a fantastic way of being a bit more sustainable. Getting fabric that's already around and using that up is great. So that's something that I'm looking to utilize in our next collection. But also the benefit of offshore fabric mills is you're getting organic fabric content. I have a content that I've sourced through my previous experience as well, that I can get organic content at a great minimum order quantity, which can be really tricky when you're doing offshore fabric mills. Oftentimes I found as a small business, it can be really hard to, to reach those MOQs. So they're just too high and unachievable. And even if you had the cash flow to be able to purchase quite high quantities, then you're left with all this dead stock. Yeah, so exactly. It kind of defeats the purpose there. So managing that as well to what is your design, I guess, focus, and how can you utilize what's at your fingertips, or can you go offshore? Is that still sustainable? What does that look like? If not, how can we make what is available and sustainable options work within the range? How can you customize that? So I guess that's a process that I do within my design, but also keeping quantities as small as possible for us. That's a big thing. So currently we're direct to customer in our business model. We're aiming to get into stockists. That's our next focus, is wholesaling. But while we're small, we have to keep our quantity small. Otherwise, we're just going to be left with all of this stock and not be able to sell it. And that in itself isn't sustainable either, just adding to the waste.
Amazing. And earlier this year, you were selected as one of seven designers to participate in the prestigious Indigenous Fashion Projects Pathways program, which is supported by David Jones. And this program is designed as something of a launch pad for emerging First Nations brands, and it provides mentoring opportunities and promotion. So it sounds pretty amazing, to be honest. Can you tell us a little bit more about the program and what your experience has been like thus far?
Yeah, it has honestly been an amazing experience so far, which, I mean, sometimes things like this can go either it's really good or it just seems like it's ticking a box and no one really benefits. But yeah, I'm happy to say this is a genuinely fantastic program. And it just seems like everyone involved, like there's a lot of moving parts to make this program happen. You've got David Jones, you've got the Indigenous Fashion Projects team, also Darwin Aboriginal Arts Fair is a part of it. So all those different aspects come together to create this space for us seven designers to be able to, you know, learn and grow, which it seems like coming from a very authentic space, which is really nice to be a part of. So yeah, we have different workshops throughout the year. Some have been focused on cultural things, others have been focused on different business aspects and learning from, I guess, other people in the industry too. Like they had a bit of a panel on one of them and just asked different questions. And we had the opportunity to ask questions too. The whole way through, it's been quite a learning experience, which I love. I love to learn more to, you know, help in whatever way to grow our business. And so, yeah, the program has definitely been fantastic at allowing us to have opportunities to learn more, to grow in our businesses in different ways. I guess we're all at different stages in our businesses as well. So catering to those different areas so that we're all still able to grow has been good so far as well. They also have a mentorship aspect of the program, which is amazing. Just being able to talk with our mentors. We've been partnered with Basic. So Mary Lou and Deb from Basic have been awesome. We've met them both, and just genuine lovely people there to, again, not just tick a box. Not tick a box at all. Just genuinely wanting to help and asking us if there's areas that we don't know things or want to learn more about, and just being really intentional about their answers and hoping to guide us in the right direction, all of that. So we've definitely felt really supported through this program and through meeting new people and gaining more context within the industry and having help to be able to do that in a great way too.
So
it's been fantastic.
It does sound incredible. It also gave you the opportunity to show at Australian Fashion Week, which is pretty cool. And you were one of the first menswear. I know there were two brands that were showing menswear, Men's Swim as well, at the Indigenous Fashion Projects Runway in May. What was it like to show at Australian Fashion Week?
It was, a massive kind of week and a half that we were there. And it's amazing to see how much really goes into producing something like this. And I'm sure I've only just seen the tip of the iceberg. I haven't seen the whole kind of everything that goes into it, all the hands that are required. But we had part of it, Darwin Aboriginal Arts Fair, Indigenous Fashion Projects, David Jones, but also Mob and Fashion were there too, helping us to navigate fittings with models and making sure everything's looking right, the styling story behind the show and working around that and seeing it come to life on the runway was awesome. And just being backstage as well while everything's happening on the runway, you're backstage like a little bit running around and making sure things are looking good. And I absolutely enjoyed being back of house as well, mm-hmm. just seeing everything happening going on. You've got the hair and makeup on one end, you've got the changing area on the other end, in between people having interviews, there's photo shoots happening in amongst it all. There's so many different moving parts, and then, you know, all the production team too, making sure that everything's happening smoothly at the front.
Yeah.
So yeah, to be a small part in making that happen is, yeah, amazing experience. Just to showcase what we have on that runway as First Nations people, I loved it. It was like an opportunity to show who we are individually as people, because I think oftentimes we can get put in a box as to who First Nations people are. And so showcasing on a runway like that with us included, seven designers, showcases that we're not just one thing. We're not whatever it is that you might have preconceived ideas about. We're all unique, and we all have something to show, a story to tell. So it's, yeah, fantastic.
Oh, that's so good to hear. And again, earlier in the season, we spoke to Denny from Nagali, and her show looked so incredible as well.
I actually got to go to that too. It was amazing.
So good.
Love Denny.
Yeah, I love Denny, exactly. But it's so wonderful to see the progression of the industry that, you know, this year for the first time, we can see a solo First Nations designer runway. And I think, you know, the industry is moving in a really encouraging and exciting direction. So as you say, you know, it's not just one thing that First Nations fashion is. And I think we're finally starting to see that diversity within First Nations fashion really being celebrated.
Yeah.
So this network and this program sounds like incredibly supportive. And where else do you look to for support? What else do you think that the industry can do to support, especially First Nations designers?
For me, I have looked to other mob in the industry. That was my first point of call when we kind of first launched the brand and were still figuring out what this whole thing really is supposed to look like. Yeah, I reached out to a couple of people and just asked if I could catch up for coffee, you know, whether it was over social media, I found their contact or was able to find their email somehow, just reaching out and having a yarn with them and asking them different questions. And you find that people tend to be quite kind and understanding because they've started at some point themselves, so they get it. So that for me is really helpful, just to have friendly faces in the industry, because the industry actually, although it seems huge, is quite small. Once you start to work in it for a little while, you learn that, oh, you know that person who also knows this person, and everyone is connected somehow. So starting off, for me, getting some context in that like space that I could relate to and understand, and who could see me as well from that perspective, was really helpful and supportive. And still in contact with them now, working with them and all that kind of thing. So if anyone else is, you know, trying to find out how to gain support, find like-minded peers. That is my biggest piece of advice. And even if you've never spoken to them before, just reach out on social media. People, you'd be surprised how many people will get back to you and make time. But otherwise, like, this program that we've been able to be a part of with Indigenous Fashion Projects is absolutely fantastic. So in terms of investing into different areas, something like that, or creating something that's not just a ticker box, obviously, is always going to be beneficial,
Yeah, and I love what Nathan's doing with Mob and Fashion as well, behind the scenes, and supporting models and photographers and all those other moving parts.
Reese Ripper as well.
Yeah, exactly. They're doing amazing work. It's really great to see. So, I mean, you've already given some amazing advice, actually, through this conversation. But thinking back to when you first graduated and the challenges that maybe you faced kind of building the brand, what is some other advice, or how do you think we might better support new graduates and young people wanting to enter the industry in Australia?
Yeah, it can seem, like I was saying before, like a huge industry, quite a mammoth thing to navigate, and oftentimes that is what is quite daunting. Like, you don't know where to start, especially if people are not quite sure where exactly they want to sit within the industry. That can make it even more daunting. So I have been part of the RMIT alumni mentoring program that they have, and so I've looked after a couple of mentees over the years, and I haven't been able to do it as often as I'd like to recently, but that part as well, I wish I knew that was a thing when I was studying, because I didn't actually know that mentoring was actually a thing. But that aspect as well, if you can get alongside a mentor who's in the industry that you're wanting to be in, ask them questions. And even if they don't specifically work in the area that you want to sit, they'll know someone. Like, I know people that don't have my specialties and likewise, and so they can point you in the right direction for sure. other things that would have been good to have is, I guess, like a panel towards the end of the year with different industry people that maybe students don't actually have the context for, but people at RMIT might have. And just holding a panel of a Q&A that could potentially help students moving forward in the industry and allowing them to ask questions at the end of it too. You never know what's going to come of stuff like that. Knowledge is power at the end of the day. So if you can find avenues to be able to source that, it's fantastic.
Yeah, I think that idea of sharing as well and sharing our contacts rather than being competitive and thinking, this is my contact.
Gatekeeping.
The gatekeeping, but actually being really open about that. I'm certainly trying to do more of that with my students for sure. And I think encouraging curiosity and that asking of constant questions.
Definitely.
You know, we often have Q&As and it's like, any questions?
Yeah,
it's
like crickets.
Crickets, exactly. But it's like, the importance of asking questions and having your voice heard as well and sort of putting yourself out there can be really valuable.
Definitely.
And as we're kind of starting to wrap up, I wondered as well, you know, part of this season is about celebrating the Melbourne or the broader Victorian fashion community. And so what do you find inspiring about living here in Melbourne? And also, how do you stay connected to country too?
Yeah, well, I just love Melbourne. There's always something happening. It's very different to Queensland, where, I guess you could describe it as a big, small city.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sleepy town, pretty much. And
Brisbane.
So, yeah, you know, I grew up there. I love that place. Beautiful beaches, beautiful weather most of the year. And my family is all still up there too. So there's an aspect of Queensland that I still call home. But in terms of Melbourne, this is very much where I live now. I don't think I'll be moving anytime soon, just in terms of there's more to do and see. And so more outlets for, you know, opportunities to be inspired. So much creative stuff happening down here. My husband as well, he works in film and TV, and so the industry for that as well is great. Melbourne is just awesome. I love Melbourne. But in terms of like staying connected to country, it's more of like a spiritual thing.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to just be physical. And so even though I might not be back home with family or whatever, there's always that connection that's running through. And even, you know, connecting to mob down here and having that community and those people around you definitely helps. But yeah, it's not necessarily you have to be tied to a place, although there are significant places and that in turn brings deeper connection too. But I think the spiritual aspect of it is always with you. You're always, you know, feeling connected.
Yeah. And finally, what can we expect from you and from Joseph and James going into the future? What projects are you working on and what can we keep our eyes peeled for?
Well, we're working on part three collections. Mm-hmm. We've got part one and part two in our current collection. We're adding part three. So I've just gone through the fun part of design and all that kind of thing. So next is on to production, getting it all kind of going. So working on that, but also I might have touched on it before, we're trying to get into stockists as well. Yeah. That's our next main focus is wholesaling. So hopefully in the near future, you'll be able to see and touch our clothing in boutique stockists as well.
Oh, that's very exciting.
Yeah.
Very exciting. Thank you so much, Juanita, for joining us today. It's been fantastic to hear more about Joseph and James and your journey as a fashion designer. To all our listeners, thank you for tuning in. If you're interested in Juanita's work, you can visit the Joseph and James website or follow them on Instagram. We'll include all those links in our show notes. If you're loving this season of the Critical Fashion Studies podcast, I invite you to join us for episode 9. I'll be talking to Josephine Root, Senior Curator at the National Wool Museum, about sustainable design in Australia. I also encourage you to subscribe to the series in your podcast app so you never miss an episode. As ever, a big thank you to Creative Victoria for their generous support, Thomas Phillips for audio engineering and co-production, Sanam Goodman for social media expertise, and Hugh Coldwell Ross for our logo. See you next time!